In the news.
Welcome, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. This is government in the news for American and Texas government. So one of the things we want to start off with is really something that's taking over the news headlines is the tragedy in Orlando, where 49 individuals were killed in a nightclub. And we've seen quite a bit of talk from President Obama, as well as two presidential candidates, as well as some number of other leaders talk about this. And so we want to start off with is really seeing how what their reaction was to this. And so first we have President Obama's initial reaction.
This is an especially heartbreaking day for all of our friends, our fellow Americans who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. The shooter targeted a nightclub where people came together to be with friends, to dance and to sing and to live. The place where they were attacked is more than a nightclub. It is a place of solidarity and empowerment where people have come together to raise awareness, to speak their minds, and to advocate for their civil rights. So this is a sobering reminder that attacks on any American, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation, is an attack on all of us and on the fundamental values of equality and dignity that define us as a country. And no act of hate or terror will ever change who we are or the values that make us Americans. Today marks the most deadly shooting in American history. The shooter was apparently armed with a handgun and a powerful assault rifle. This massacre is therefore a further reminder of how easy it is for someone to get their hands on a weapon that lets them shoot people in a school, or in a house of worship, or a movie theater, or in a nightclub. And we have to decide if that's the kind of country we want to be. And to actively do nothing is a decision as well.
Okay, so those are the statements from the President of the United States. We also had statements from both of the presumptive party nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Let's take a look at what Mrs. Clinton had to say about this.
Originally, I had intended to come to Cleveland under very different circumstances. We are heading into a general election that could be the most consequential of our lifetimes. But today is not a day for politics. The Orlando terrorist may be dead, but the virus that poisoned his mind remains very much alive. And we must attack it with clear eyes, steady hands, unwavering determination and pride in our country and our values. As president, I will make identifying and stopping lone wolves a top priority. And I will make sure our law enforcement and intelligence professionals have all the resources they need to get the job done. Even as we make sure our security officials get the tools they need to prevent attacks, it's essential that we stop terrorists from getting the tools they need to carry out the attacks. And that is especially true when it comes to assault weapons like those used in Orlando and San Bernardino. If the FBI is watching you for suspected terrorist links, you shouldn't be able to just go buy a gun with no questions asked. And you shouldn't be able to exploit loopholes and evade criminal background checks by buying online or at a gun show. And yes, if you're too dangerous to get on a plane, you are too dangerous to buy a gun in America. As president, I will work with our great tech companies from Silicon Valley to Boston to step up our game. We have to do a better job intercepting ISIS's communications. Inflammatory, anti-Muslim rhetoric and threatening to ban the families and friends of Muslim Americans, as well as millions of Muslim business people and tourists from entering our country, hurts the vast majority of Muslims who love freedom and hate terror. The terrorists in Orlando targeted LGBT Americans out of hatred and bigotry. And an attack on any American is an attack on all Americans. There is no better rebuke to the terrorists and all those who hate. Our open, diverse society is an asset in the struggle against terrorism, not a liability.
So as you see there, you have, again, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton providing her comments. And so it was a planned speech in Cleveland, but in response to that, to the terrorist attacks, that changed really what she wanted to say. But we also have comments from Mr. Donald Trump, the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party.
Back on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, was the worst terrorist strike on our soil since September 11th. So much carnage, such a disgrace. It's an assault on the ability of free people to live their lives, love who they want, and express their identity. But the current politically correct response cripples our ability to talk and to think and act clearly. The killer, whose name I will not use or ever say, was born an Afghan of Afghan parents who immigrated to the United States. The bottom line is that the only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here. We have a dysfunctional immigration system which does not permit us to know who we let into our country, and it does not permit us to protect our citizens properly. The immigration laws of the United States give the president powers to suspend entry into the country of any class of persons. When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats. We cannot continue to allow thousands upon thousands of people to pour into our country, many of whom have the same thought process as this savage killer. Many of the principles of radical Islam are incompatible with Western values and institutions. I want a mainstream immigration policy that promotes American values. Why would we admit people who support violent hatred? Hillary Clinton can never claim to be a friend of the gay community as long as she continues to support immigration policies that bring Islamic extremists to our country and who suppress women, gays, and anyone else who doesn't share their views or values. Ask yourself, who is really the friend of women and the LB and LGBT community? Donald Trump with actions or Hillary Clinton with her words? Immigration is a privilege, and we should not let anyone into this country who doesn't support our communities, all of our communities, every single one of them. The Muslim community, so importantly, they have to work with us. They have to cooperate with law enforcement and turn in the people who they know are bad, and they know it. And they have to do it, and they have to do it forthwith. When I'm president, I pledge to protect and defend all Americans who live inside our borders. Wherever they come from, wherever they were born, I don't care. All Americans living here and following our laws, not other laws, will be protected.
Okay, so there you have it, the back and forth between the president, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump. Welcome to Presidential Politics 2016. This wasn't the end of it, though. President Obama, after hearing the comments of Mr. Trump, actually had a response directly to the statements that Trump offered after Orlando.
Enough talking about being tough on terrorism. Actually be tough on terrorism and stop making it easy as possible for terrorists to buy assault weapons. For a while now, the main contribution of some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have made in the fight against ISIL is to criticize this administration and me for not using the phrase radical Islam. They know who the nature of the enemy is. So there's no magic to the phrase radical Islam. It's a political talking point. It's not a strategy. And if we fall into the trap of painting all Muslims with a broad brush and and imply that we are at war with an entire religion, then we are doing the terrorist work for them. But we are now seeing how dangerous this kind of mindset and this kind of thinking can be. We're starting to see where this kind of rhetoric and loose talk and sloppiness about who exactly we're fighting, where this can lead us. We now have proposals from the presumptive Republican nominee for President of the United States to bar all Muslims from emigrating to America. We hear language that singles out immigrants and suggests entire religious communities are complicit in violence. Where does this stop? Because that's not the America we want. It doesn't reflect our democratic ideals. It won't make us more safe, it will make us less safe, fueling ISIL's notion that the West hates Muslims. We've gone through moments in our history before when we acted out of fear, and we came to regret it. This is a country founded on basic freedoms, including freedom of religion. And if we ever abandoned those values, we would not only make it a lot easier to radicalize people here and around the world, but we would have betrayed the very things we are trying to protect. And then the terrorists would have won. And we cannot let that happen. I will not let that happen.
Okay, there you have it. A little bit of repetition there from the first clip versus the last clip. But the last clip is, you know, President Obama's response to some of the tweets and then some of the statements that Donald Trump in particular made in response to the Orlando tragedy. So, and we, you know, Professor McDaniel and I don't want to, you know, just focus on these sort of micro politics. You know, we certainly have our own, you know, views about Orlando and have, you know, nothing but respect for the victims and respect for the law enforcement people who put their lives on the line for this. So, you know, when we inject politics into it, it's because, you know, the tragedy does have serious public policy consequences, and there'll be invocations of public opinion as America tries to figure out what to do, you know, with the threat that is new and something we haven't really dealt with before. Right?
Yeah, with any tragedy, you always ask, okay, what happened? What caused this? And one of the things we're seeing are really several frames being put forward in discussion of this. And so President Obama, in an initial speech, really talked about, really put forth a gun control frame. And so this is, again, the idea of a mass shooting. And President Obama's got, you know, over the past few years, he's becoming much more, I guess, despondent in talking about mass shootings. Like, I have to talk to you all about this, you know, at least once a month I'm coming to you about some type of mass shooting. And so you have the gun control issue coming up in terms of his frame. Like, look, this is a problem of why is it other Western industrialized nations don't have this problem, but we do. But you also see other frames coming into play as well. Whereas Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump focus more on the idea of terrorism and controlling and trying to control terrorists, you see that frame coming through. Whereas Hillary Clinton is, you know, and Donald Trump, and even to some extent, you may even see this with President Obama's idea of increasing surveillance to stop terrorism, and that's what they seem to agree on. But they seem to disagree on. They seem to agree on one way to stop terrorism is to increase surveillance, but they seem to disagree on what they should do in terms of banning Muslims, things like that. But then finally, you see agreement in all three in terms of bringing the LGBT community into the fold of saying, no, these are Americans. By hurting them, you are hurting us, as opposed to in the past where some groups may have seen them as a deviant group or something like that. They're like, no, these are our people. You are harming our people. And so you see this very protective language towards the LGBT community. And so, I mean, it's very interesting to see the variety of ways in which they're talking about this and, you know, how this will play out in the future in terms of policy action to try to prevent future events such as this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Professor McDaniel and I talk about framing, and this is something that we'll get into in the media module, we talk about framing, we're talking about the way in which events are perceived or presented. And so, you know, you could frame an issue in a variety of different ways. As Professor McDaniel said, the president tends to frame the Orlando tragedy as the manifestation of, you know, lax gun control laws. And there's a reason that President Obama prefers that frame. I think it's consistent with his own sincere beliefs and ideology that, you know, the way to understand the tragedy, you know, the way to deal with the tragedy is to focus on the issue of availability of guns. But there are other people who have different views on this, and those are manifest in their frames. So Donald Trump comes out and he says, look, the problem here is radical Islam. We need to see the tragedy through that lens. And so when he talks about, well, what do you do? If you believe that, if you think that, you know, the core problem here is Islamic fundamentalism, then it suggests a whole different set of public policies and responses. And so part of this, you know, we would probably observe from a large-scale point of view, from the 20,000-foot perspective, right? What we're talking about are, you know, people with legitimate differences over how to view what's going on. Now, they're playing out in a very political context. It's a 2016 election. They're presidential candidates who are trying to get elected. They're trying to convince voters to trust them with the country. And so what part of what you're seeing now is a battle over whose perspective, whose frame is most compelling to people. You know, and it's probably the case that Democrats are more receptive to the frame offered up by the president and to a slightly lesser degree Hillary Clinton, who we'll talk about here in a second. And Republicans are a little more likely to, you know, adopt or respond to the frame offered by Donald Trump. But it's fascinating to hear that, you know, if you guys are out there listening to this and you think these people are talking past each other, well, yeah. I mean, and I would submit to you that that's legitimate. That while there's a political angle to it, they're just different ways of viewing what's happened. And it doesn't make them any more or less correct or appropriate. Although you do have some people who are turned off by just talking about politics after a tragedy like this. But I think that's unavoidable. I'd also point out, just from a stagecraft standpoint, if you go back and take a look at those different statements, I think Hillary wins hands down on flags. Trump has two flags. Hillary's got two flags plus, like, the Patton background with, you know, the big stripes in the background, so she looks pretty good. The president, and again, not to focus too much on stagecraft, but it is relevant. The president is presidential. You know, Professor McDaniel and I were talking off air about, you know, the tone that President Obama can strike. You know, he's the only one of these three people not running for office again. You know, he's burnishing his legacy, certainly. But, you know, he can come out and he has this sort of gravity and tone, and he doesn't seem to be as politicking as the other two. I couldn't help but be struck by that contrast, watching those three statements, you know, kind of together. But let's bring it back and talk a little more generally about the three different, you know, kind of aspects of this. We're talking about, you know, guns and gun control. We're talking about gay rights, and we're talking about Islamic extremism and some of the different policies associated with that. I think we've prepared a little bit of data on some of these. So three things in particular. So Donald Trump has suggested, a temporary ban on immigration of Muslims to the United States. So that's one thing we want to talk about. We also want to give you guys a few numbers on support towards gun control, assault rifle bans, and things of that nature. And then we also have some public opinion on gay rights. Let's start with the first slide, which is just public opinion on the Trump proposal. All right, so y'all can take a look at that. And what you see is that it's a proposal. So this is, again, let's be clear. I think President Obama probably intentionally misrepresented this slightly. It's not a full and forever ban on all Muslim immigration. It's a temporary ban. What Trump says, it's a ban until we can figure out what's going on. Okay, well, that's actually the way it was worded in this particular question. So if you're sort of surprised by the level of support for this, Trump's particular language was used in the frame that was offered to people when they were asked this for polling purposes. So a temporary ban on Muslims traveling to the United States. And you can see that amongst all respondents, that's the cluster of bar graphs over to the far left, right? There's basically 50% support for that. Around 40, slightly less than 40%, so about 38% opposition. And then a cluster of people, you know, about 10% who say they don't know. You can see there's a partisan divide on reaction here, with Republicans being the most supportive of a temporary ban and Democrats being the least supportive or the most opposed. But you see, it's not a proposal that is viewed, at least at this point in this particular poll, as being crazy or outlandish. In fact, it enjoys majority support, bare majority, but majority support, and fairly considerable support amongst independents and Republicans. Right? So when, you know, people talk about Trump's extremism, and Professor McDaniel and I are agnostic on whether this particular policy proposal's, you know, good or bad. We have our own views, but we'll keep them to ourselves. You can see that as far as the public's concerned, what Trump is saying doesn't strike them as being crazy. right? And that's important to recognize. You know, one of the reasons Donald Trump keeps saying these things, and this particular proposal in particular, is that there's a decent amount of public support for it.
Yeah, and this is, there's actually a very large literature about this, that again, when people feel threatened, and this poll was taken right after, shortly after the Paris attacks, the San Bernardino attacks, and so there was this very, this heightened, I guess, attention to radical Islam or Muslim extremists, and so because of this, like, no, we need to stop, abandon all Muslims. Now, again, what this also feeds into is, you know, it stops the Syrian refugees. You know, there are problems in terms of implementing this, in the sense that you're saying, okay, we're cutting off humanitarian aid, and this is where some people say, no, this is where it's incorrect.
We need to be careful about. We just presented some data, and it was in response to a particular question. But as Professor McDaniel suggests, how you ask that question is going to significantly influence the results. So you notice in that frame, it said a temporary ban on Muslim immigration. I think if you said a ban on Muslim immigration, I think that would drop support. On the other hand, I think if you said a ban on Muslim immigration from areas where there's Islamic extremism or lots of Islamic extremism, you would probably see an increase in support. So, you know, I guess that's one way of saying something we'll also talk about later in the semester, and that is that, you know, public opinion is, you know, kind of malleable. People don't walk around with real strong opinions about immigration policy towards, you know, Muslim countries. It can be substantially influenced by how you word it. So it's interesting to listen to Trump say it's a temporary ban until we figure out what's going on. That's his best play. Where President Obama was saying, you know, there's some people, meaning Donald Trump, who want to ban all Muslims and ban immigration. Well, that's not quite what Trump was saying, although it's not a, you know, it's not a crazy sort of extrapolation, but that frame, that way of framing the issue, does much better in terms of mobilizing support to President Obama's position or the anti-Trump position. So it's interesting to watch them talk about the issue and try to finesse it a little bit with an eye towards public opinion.
Now, what's also important about this in terms of that this is not people see this as somewhat reasonable, because again, about 1 in 3 Democrats support this, so it's not a small portion of Democrats who support this idea when it was brought forth in March. Now, again, that wouldn't have stopped the thing that happened in Orlando, because he was born in the U.S., right. And so it wouldn't have prevented the Orlando tragedy. But the president does have the power to do this. So there's an article in the Washington Post today, which actually says that, you know, Donald Trump is mostly correct. So going back from the 1950 immigration law, the president has the power to restrict certain individuals. Now, it was put forth mainly to stop communists from coming into the U.S., but President Obama has used this by saying that if you are associated with war crimes, you cannot enter the U.S. And so there is the power to do this. And again, you run into problems, okay, what's the litmus test for saying someone is Muslim or non-Muslim, things like that. But the president does have the power to bar certain individuals from entering in the U.S., and this is not something far-fetched. So President Obama has used this, and again, if Mr. Trump is elected, he could use this as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. I'd actually sort of go to the broader constitutional issue, too. If you all read the Constitution, there's really nothing in the Constitution. There's a lot of stuff about citizenship, and subsequent Supreme Court decisions have clarified questions of citizenship. There's really not much about immigration. You know, it's essentially something that's sort of left to the states, but through the course of American history, the federal government has become, you know, obviously as sort of the broad protector of boundaries, has become more and more responsible for immigration policy. But Professor McDaniel is exactly right. There's not really much constitutional guidance with respect to immigration. So, you know, initially Congress, and as the president has kind of ascended with respect to policy powers, and Congress has declined a little bit, the president in the 20th century and the 21st century has become very important players with respect to immigration policy. And so a lot of immigration policy is actually kind of left to, you know, executive construction and how the executive thinks he or she needs to sort of fulfill the obligations of office. So the president does have some leeway here. So as we listen to President Obama and Trump's different perspectives, you know, the president basically is going to be the player on these issues. And so that's important to keep in mind. Now, what I think we probably want to do now is move ahead to the second element. So we talked about Islamic extremism and immigration. Let's talk a little bit about gun control, which was, of course, the focal point of Hillary Clinton and President Obama's sort of reaction to the Orlando episode. So we have a public opinion here on some gun control issues. And this is simply supportive versus opposed. you know, with the scale being strongly support, somewhat support, somewhat opposed, strongly opposed, stricter gun control laws in the United States. And I believe that's actually how the question was framed. So it's very generic, right? We're not asking about, you know, should you outlaw grenade launchers on semi-automatic? No, no, no. It's not that particular. It's sort of just a general gun control question. And you can see, right, that there's the far left, again, is all respondents. Then we move to the party breakdown. And you can see the far left indicates that there is strong support for stricter gun control laws in the United States. Now, again, that's left to the imagination of the respondent here as to what the particulars are. And you do see, again, a partisan divide where Republicans are much less supportive, although they're not totally opposed. That's an important point to take away from the graph. Democrats are strongly supportive of stricter gun control laws. So you see, again, a partisan divide. But in this case, you know, if we're talking about in political terms, why does President Obama want to talk about and Hillary Clinton want to talk about Orlando in terms of gun control? And why does Donald Trump want to talk about it in terms of Islamic extremism? Well, if you were cynical out there, I know you're not, but say you were, you would be tempted to say that, well, Democrats want to talk about gun control because they're on the correct side or the popular side of that issue, whereas Republicans want to talk about Islamic extremism because being bullish or stronger on Islamic extremism is a winning issue for them. And I think that's manifest in the numbers that you see right here. Okay, so that's a broad view, but, you know, something we wanted to make sure that you guys were all aware of.
And in particular, there was the issue of semi-automatic weapons. And so there's also a question about the support for banning semi-automatic weapons. They were banned, but I think about 12 years ago.
Yeah, so obviously 2003, 2004 when that law.
Yeah, the ban was not renewed. And so that's why you're seeing the rise in this. And so there actually is some poll information, some information on that. And as we see, there is a significant level of support for banning assault-style weapons. So again, you see about close to 50% strongly agree. You see Democrats, 60% of Democrats agree with this. And you see the plurality of Republicans agree with this as well. So there is, you know, if you focus on the assault style weapons, I do believe there is support for this. Now, again, this was taken back in December of 2015. So this was before the San Bernardino attack.
After Paris.
Yeah, after Paris, but before the San Bernardino attack, maybe a week or so before that. And a week before some of the other recent shootings that we've seen. And in particular, people have been pointing to the AR-15, which is a semi-automatic rifle, which has been used in multiple of shootings. And some people argue, like, no, we need to pull back on these style weapons. So President Obama's made this argument. Hillary Clinton's made this argument. So the argument is, so even in their discussion of gun control, it's not take away all guns, but take away certain guns. And I think that might be a more popular way of trying to get things pushed through, but it's something we'll have to see what happens, because this is an issue that's central on the agenda.
I think what you all want to bear in mind, a couple things. Again, we're supposed to give you a broad perspective on these things. You know, again, there's a constitutional element here. We talked about immigration not having a lot of constitutional guidance. Well, on guns, there's a very specific constitutional provision, that is the Second Amendment, you know, the right to bear arms. And I think we wanted to point out that there is a recent Supreme Court ruling here that's very relevant, the Heller decision. It's 2008 or 2009, I'm fuzzy on exactly what year it is. But this is a majority opinion actually penned by the late Antonin Scalia, who passed away last year, but a very conservative member of the Supreme Court. And it essentially really backed the interpretation of the Second Amendment as being something like a solemn guarantee of the right of individuals to bear arms, to have access to and to have guns. And that's been sort of the guiding principle in the last 8 or 9 years. And people have interpreted the Heller decision, that's H-E-L-L-E-R, the Heller decision, as being kind of the Supreme Court finally weighing in a very definitive way on the gun issue. However, and I've been reading some articles in the aftermath of Orlando, and actually legal scholars say that, well, the Heller decision isn't quite as cut and dried as many people think. That in fact, in the wake of the Heller decision, there have been quite a few court cases in which the court has okayed both local and state controls or restrictions of access to guns. And, you know, actually, if you actually read the Heller decision, even Scalia's opinion suggests that there are some exceptions. You know, he basically says, look, like all constitutional guarantees, there are limits. You know, you can't walk around with nuclear weapons, for instance. I mean, you know, there is a line to be drawn. Okay, so, you know, as you all are out there trying to figure out what you think of this issue, you know, it is true, there's a robust debate about the Second Amendment and whether these gun control laws conflict with Second Amendment rights and where do we draw the line. There's also a huge debate, which we can't possibly get into now, about whether, in fact, some of these bans or restrictions are appropriate, whether they would work with respect to reducing mass shootings. And as I said, you all can read as much as you want on that from every particular political perspective that's out there. And it's, you know, from a purely kind of constitutional and public policy issue, it's one of the most fascinating and important conversations that we're having right now as a country. What do we want to do? You know, when there actually is a specific constitutional provision, but it was written about the militia and it was written a long time ago, and certainly before we had automatic weapons, certainly before we had radical Islam, at least in the context we see it today. So what do we think about this? What do we do as Americans? And that's part of the conversation that the candidates are having and that, you know, we would encourage you all to think about.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge civil liberties argument in regards to one, gun control, but then also the monitoring of Americans, where, you know, the idea that Hillary Clinton said, I will pay attention to, you know, more attention to lone wolf terrorists. Well, the problem, in order to do that, that means you have to basically spy on private citizens. Yeah. And so she said, I work with the tech companies, which means that she's going to find ways to develop software to follow you, but also software to crack open your iPhone, things like that. And so this is seen as, okay, in order to alleviate this threat, I'm going to have to infringe upon your civil liberties. And again, we're seeing a lot of this in terms of level of support for monitoring Muslim neighborhoods. Yeah. But it's also going to be interesting to what degree are Americans willing to say, okay, fine, I'm willing to have, you know, Loretta Lynch and others, you know, monitor my emails so I can just in case there might be something going on.
No, there's this whole element. Y'all have probably seen this morning as we were coming into work. The wife of the shooter has become a major issue, and you know, you all saw in the clips Trump and Hillary, but especially Trump alluding to, you know, these communities. Presumably, Trump is referring to Muslim communities need to step up. He wasn't just talking about condemning the violence. He was talking about alerting authorities about action within their own communities. And y'all might think that's, in some ways, it has sort of a chilling connotation in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, you know, in response to 50 people dead in Orlando, maybe we're willing to accept that. But you know, we were talking about the wife. The wife knew about this guy's tendencies and did not report them. Encourage him to get help. Wasn't that the deal?
Yes, she wanted him. She tried to stop him from doing it.
Right.
And so this is his second wife. So his first wife, right. He's divorced. His first wife commented on the fact that he was bipolar and abusive. The second wife actually helped him in terms of some of the reconnaissance, knew what he planned, and tried to get him to stop, but not report it ahead of time.
Yeah, and this is an element to Trump's comments. I don't know whether Trump's comments were made before or after this information came to light, but you know that. Element of it is also, you know, very interesting about, you know, in this case, you know, is she a criminal at this point for not going to the authorities on this, you know? And by the way, just as a small but really kind of important legal note, if you're married to someone, you are not compelled, you know, to in a court case to testify against them. That's considered sort of privilege, you know, marital information. But if you know of a murder plot, for instance, while you're not necessarily compelled to testify against them in court, you can be held responsible as an accessory to a crime. And so, well, first of all, if your personal life is like that, please, you know, bear that in mind. But in this case, you know, she's probably in a lot of trouble. But this question of civil liberties is one we grapple with all the time. We grappled with in the wake of 9/11, with the Patriot Act and, you know, surveillance responses to a country that, you know, as a country that has been assaulted and, you know, needs to figure out how to deal with, you know, a threat, you know, that's very different from the threats that we've had in the past. Do you want to move on to gay rights?
Yeah, so the final frame here is really in regards to gay rights. And really, it's interesting to see that all three of the speakers, the president, Secretary Clinton, and Mr. Trump, all talked about the idea that the LGBT community is part of the American community, that they are not outside of that. We are there to protect them. Even Mr. Trump going for as well, like, I am the true friend of the LGBT community. And, you know, while he has taken a stance against, he was for gay marriage, he took a stance against gay marriage, he has come out in support of transgender rights, specifically in regards to the selection of bathrooms. I think he's backed off on that. President Obama's been pushing that pretty strongly. But if we take a look at basically public opinion towards homosexuals, we see one, if we just take a look at a trend from Gallup, that the question is, do you think that gay or lesbian relationships between consenting adults should or should not be legal? You're seeing that, you know, we move from the public being split to where you have about 68% of the public saying it should be legal. There's no problem. About 28% saying it should not be legal. So there is still a significant portion of the population that is opposed to these types of relationships. However, there's growing support for these relationships.
Right. The trend here runs from the late 70s all the way through current data. Gallup has been monitoring this for a long time. So, and by the way, it's not just in the public. Professor McDaniel mentioned that Trump's position has shifted over time. President Obama's position has shifted over time, at least on the specific issue of gay marriage. I want to distinguish that from the broader attitudes towards gays and lesbians. But, you know, President Obama was ambivalent to opposed. Hillary Clinton was opposed initially. So this evolution that's occurred across, you know, the American landscape, we've seen it even, you know, amongst stalwarts of the progressive movement, you know, Obama and Clinton. So there's been a lot of change, but as Professor McDaniel says, I think that I would point out two things. The trend, which is towards more tolerant opinions over time, accepting opinions over time. Yes. But secondly, that there is a chunk of the American public that's still not comfortable with gay and lesbian rights, maybe not be the right word, but doesn't want any kind of particular accommodation or recognition, I suppose, might be the most generous way to put it.
Yeah.
Right. Although if you switch, on this question of sort of framing, if you switch the frame to talk about, you know, should we allow discrimination towards gays and lesbians, that chunk who says, well, I'm not really supportive of gay marriage, if you switch it to, well, are you supportive of discrimination, that number collapses. There are very, very few people who would, you know, support open discrimination, at least in response to public opinion polls. In their heart, who knows? But
yeah, so the next slide actually shows the idea of creating laws to prevent discrimination against LGBT community in regards to housing and employment. And this has really been a big issue where you're really seeing, you know, that, you know, if we look across the partisan spectrum, that people do support these types of laws. Well, again, you're getting more support from Democrats than with Republicans. You're still seeing a significant level of support from Republicans of the idea of creating laws to prevent discrimination against these individuals. I think that's where we're really seeing drastic changes, where the idea of, like, I may not like what they're doing, but I don't believe they should be discriminated against. I don't believe they should be banned from certain types of housing or employment because of that. Now, again, there are some groups that have caveats, specifically religious groups, of saying, you know, we don't believe in these types of relationships. So does that mean that we would have to openly hire somebody who is homosexual that goes against our wishes? And this is one of the big things you're seeing in terms of religious freedoms. And this is something that's going to be played out in the courts as time goes on. We don't have time to go into that right now, but this is something that's going to be played out for quite a bit. But what we really wanted to show you is, it really, there are kind of three themes that were brought about by the president and the two candidates. Terrorism, specifically in regards to Muslims, gun control, but it's also gay rights. And we really want to show you public opinion and show how the public thinks about these and where they line up with the general sentiments of the public. And so, as you can see, when it comes to banning Muslims, there is, again, a considerable amount of support for this. So Trump is supportive of, again, this temporary ban. It's not a permanent ban, but a temporary ban. Trump is, you know, people don't think this is crazy. About half are against it, half are for it. In regards to gun control, there is some support for certain types of gun control, but not overall. Democrats are much more supportive of gun control than others. But in regards to the LGBT community, where all three seem to be in agreement of protecting this group, you do see the public becoming more and more supportive of their rights.
Right, and it's, you know, we would point out, again, if you're talking about competing frames or how to, you know, in a very cynical way, leverage a situation for political advantage, and we're not suggesting that's all that's going on. I think, you know, the candidates, I think, are pretty sincere in their views on what's going on. But, you know, if you're a strategist and you're looking at this, what you see, as Professor McDaniel suggests, is that all three candidates are in agreement about, you know, this is an assault on the gay and lesbian community. that this is tragic, that this is something that can't be tolerated, and there's a reason for that. I mean, not only, you know, morally and ethically, but nobody thinks that, you know, the gay and lesbian community is an outcast, is ostracized, is separate from the American community. And all agree that this particular targeting is especially pernicious, you know, especially, you know, awful and dangerous and repugnant, right? So there's agreement on that. There's not a whole lot of public policy differentiation there, you know. So all of them acknowledge that, but then you see the candidates diverge, with the Republican candidate moving more towards identification of terrorism and Islamic extremism is what ought to be our focal point, but the Democrats tending to move more towards gun control laws and stricter control of access to these things is the appropriate public policy response, right? So it's kind of fascinating to watch for the fight over framing this issue and presenting it and, you know, obviously at some point kind of wrangling some kind of political advantage from it. All right, so one last thing we want to talk about today, I guess, is Professor McDaniel's got some thoughts on Texas versus Delaware, which is not the first game of the next football season, unfortunately.
No.
I'm sure we'd crush the Blue Hens.
Oh, the Blue Hens have no chance whatsoever. So Delaware, the state that I visited one time, and I was like, oh, okay.
Did
that's
you really?
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Not much. I was thinking about going to Delaware State.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. What's their nickname?
Oh my God, I forgot.
Okay.
That's how important Delaware State was to me.
That won't be on the exam.
Yeah, it was a real quick trip through, just looking at.
There's no such thing as not a quick trip through Delaware.
Yeah, everything's, I mean, the fact that, yeah, Delaware is a small state. But even though the state is small, and it again is the home of our Vice President, Diamond Joe Biden, Delaware's gotten itself into a bit of a pickle, where Texas, Arkansas, along with 19 other states, have sued Delaware over its handling of Western Union funds. Let's hear from our own Attorney General, Ken Paxton, on what Delaware has been doing wrong.
Today, we ask the U.S. Supreme Court to resolve a serious dispute about unclaimed monies from financial institutions between a coalition of 21 states and the state of Delaware. Every year, tens of millions of dollars in official checks go unclaimed. This is not uncommon within the financial services industry. However, what is uncommon is Delaware's instructions that if you are incorporated in Delaware, you should send all money from all unclaimed official checks to Delaware, no matter where the financial transaction was initiated. Thus, Delaware is claiming for itself all monies from all unclaimed official checks from every state in the nation. This practice not only violates federal law, but is wrong and unfair. On February 10, 2015, an independent auditor for 20 states concluded that over $150 million in unclaimed official checks has been improperly claimed and received by Delaware. That is an average of approximately $7.5 million per state. Extrapolated, all 49 states with claims against Delaware could be missing nearly $400 million.
You have a problem with that, Professor McDaniel?
Well, I mean, the amount of money that each state lost is minimal. I'm talking about, again, $7.5 million, but the collective amount that Delaware has gained of close to $400 million, that's quite a bit. And so this is an example of federalism in action, where in the past, or the Articles of Confederation, if Texas had a beef with Delaware, you know, there was no strong central government to solve this. And in fact, you had problems where states were actually going to war with each other and the central government cannot solve this. This is a great case of really seeing, you know, the power of a strong central government. In the case where Texas is constantly suing the federal government or constantly at odds with the federal government over things, there are some things where Texas is like, look, we need your help on this. And this is a great example of seeing federalism, but also state competition and how the federal government is there to step in when the states have conflicts with each other.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we emphasized in the conversation, I guess it was was federalism or is our constitutional conversation, was that, you know, the federal government has jurisdiction over certain kinds of cases. Federal court system in particular, here we're talking about the Supreme Court, has jurisdiction over certain kinds of cases. And they're fairly obvious. One is when the United States is party to a suit, right? So in those instances, the Supreme Court is, you know, the appropriate court. And, you know, the reason is obvious, which is who else could decide? You can't let a state court decide, you know, a case where the United States is a party to the suit. Another instance in which the Supreme Court has jurisdiction is a case in which two states are suing each other. right? I mean, I guess you could go to Minnesota or something and ask them to adjudicate a Texas versus Delaware case, but it really doesn't make much sense. But the U.S. court system, in this case the Supreme Court, has jurisdiction over those sorts of cases. So part of this is interesting just as an illustration of a principle we talked about, and that is, you know, when the Constitution was penned, part of it was to reconcile some of the problems with the Articles of Confederation, and part of it was to strengthen the federal government, you know, to give it a little more teeth, to allow it to do some of the things it needed to do. And this is an instance where only the federal government could really, you know, resolve a case like this. So that's sort of a general frame, the big picture. But the specific claim, you know, that Delaware is basically, you know, kind of running amok here and gaining a lot of money that it really has no right to, no entitlement to. What do you do if a state's kind of engaged in those sorts of activities? And so Texas does. So you saw Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Greg Abbott, the current governor, was Attorney General. And one of the things, was it? I love the line, at some point someone asked Greg Abbott, what do you do as Attorney General of Texas? And his response was, well, I wake up in the morning, you know, I get dressed, and I sue the U.S. government. And there's some truth to that. Yes. I think at some point Texas had, you know, a couple dozen lawsuits against other states and the national government. And it's not just Texas, although Texas seems particularly aggressive in this kind of thing. You know, that's what state's attorney general do. They're protecting their rights as a state against other states, as well as what they when they feel the United States government is infringing upon their rights. So, you know, it's a particularly American situation. I don't think this is going, you know, there are other federal republics, Germany, you know, as an example, Russia is a federation, you know, but I don't think they have the same sorts of issues where states and are suing each other and suing the federal government quite to the level that we have here in the U.S.
No, and I think, you know, one of the things to point out about Texas and suing the federal government, it doesn't matter who is in office. So when President Bush was in office, Texas was suing the federal government. So it's a common thing, and you see other states doing this because, again, this idea of states' rights of, you know, it really states want to say, okay, how much can I get away with, or to what degree can I put some boundaries away from the federal government? Because again, the idea is having some outsider kind of intrude upon your day-to-day business. You really see this coming up with the EPA, but along with other laws. We've seen this right now with the suit with the transgender bathrooms, which we'll talk about later on. But this is a common thing, and this is one of the things you need to be aware of in regards to really some of the difficulties you have with getting policies passed, and that a state does affects other states. New York and Virginia were in a suit going back to the gun control over gun control, where New York was accusing Virginia's lax laws for contributing to gun violence in the state of New York. And this happens a lot. States are going to be in conflict. You see states suing each other over water rights.
I was going to say water rights is the big deal. I'm from California originally, and California is constantly involved in suits involving access to the Colorado River. So they're in suits with Arizona and Nevada over this sort of stuff. If they could, they would, you know, Californians would sue each other over this. Texas hasn't had quite the same history, but it has a history with Oklahoma and New Mexico over water rights. And as water becomes, you know, more and more scarce, it's hard to imagine now after the rain we've had this spring. But as recently as last year, we were in such a serious drought condition. There's all sorts of concern, you know, about what to do about this. And part of it involves, you know, rivers that originate in other states. And, you know, what do you do if someone dams your river upstream, you know, and dries up your water supply? Usually it's going to involve, in the United States case, a lawsuit against somebody else. So,
yeah. And again, these are things that we'll cover as we go on. So, again, we send our condolences to the families and the victims of the shooting in Orlando. And we want to close with Anderson Cooper reading the names of those who were killed in this attack. We hope you have a good week, and we hope that you stay safe.
We begin tonight with their names, the names of the 48 out of 49 people who have so far been identified, victims of the deadliest mass shooting in American history, a massacre that happened in a gay nightclub just a block from where I'm standing, just down that road two nights ago. There is one name I want to tell you that you will not hear in this broadcast tonight, one picture of a person you won't see. We will not say the gunman's name or show his photograph. It's been shown far too much already. Over the next 2 hours, we'll certainly tell you about the investigation, all the latest, what we know about what drove the shooter to do the unthinkable. But in the next 2 hours, we want to try to keep the focus where we think it belongs, on the people whose lives were cut short. And we're going to start tonight by honoring them. There are more than a list of names. There are people who loved and were loved, There are people with families and friends and dreams. And the truth is, we don't know much about some of them. We want you to hear their names and a little bit about who they were. Edward Sotomayor Jr. He worked at a travel agency that catered to the gay community. His family says he was witty, charming, and that he always left things better than he found them. He was 34 years old. Stanley Almodovar III, he was a pharmacy technician. He was the last video that we saw of him was posted on social media that showed him laughing and singing on the way to that nightclub. He was just 23. Luis Omar Ocasio-Cappo, he was a dancer and a barista. He was just 20 years old. Luis Vielma, he worked at the Harry Potter ride at Universal Orlando. He was just 22. Juan Ramon Guerrero, his cousin said Juan came out to his family just this year and was afraid they might not accept him, but they did, and they embraced his boyfriend as well. He was 22. Christopher Andrew Leonone, known as Drew, he was Juan's boyfriend, and his mom says he established the Gay-Straight Alliance at his high school. He was 32 years old. Eric Ivan Ortiz Rivera, a friend says he was always willing to help everybody and sacrificed a lot for his family. He was 36. Peter O. Gonzalez Cruz, he worked at a UPS store, memorized apparently all the regular customers' names. He could make anyone smile, his friend said. He was just 22. Kimberly K.J. Morris moved from Hawaii to Florida just a few months ago to help her mother and her grandmother. She was a bouncer at Pulse Nightclub. She was 37. Eddie Justice was an accountant who texted his mother from the club, texted his mother saying, "Mommy, I love you." He was 30. Enrique Rios, a friend says he was cool and a funny dude who could tell people don't let the world hold you back from your dreams. He was 25. Anthony Luis Laureano Dizla, a talented dancer born in Puerto Rico. He was 25. Jonathan Antonio Camuy Vega, he worked for Telemundo, first in Puerto Rico and then in Orlando. He was just about to turn 25. Corey James Connell was a student at Valencia Community College and hoped to become a firefighter. He was 21. Mercedes Marisol Flores, her father says she was a happy girl who had so many dreams. She was 26. Dianca Deirdre Drayden, her family called her Didi. She was a bartender at Pulse. She was just 32. Miguel Angel Honorato managed a Mexican restaurant. A colleague says he was an excellent boss and a good friend. He was 30. Jason Benjamin Josephat, a student at Southern Technical College, where a faculty member calls him a sweet kid with a bright future. He was 19. Daryl Roman Burt II was a financial aid officer at Kaiser University, was passionate about volunteer work. He was 29. Jean Carlos Mendez Perez was a perfume salesman. Apparently hit the gym almost every day, and his friend said he was always happy. He was 35. Perez's longtime partner, Luis Daniel Wilson Leon, grew up in a small town in Puerto Rico and was a shoe store manager. He was 37. They died together. Frankie Jimmy De Jesus Velasquez, a professional dancer specializing in a traditional folk dance of his native Puerto Rico. He was 50. Amanda Alvear, she was a nursing student at the University of South Florida, was 25. Martin Benitez Torres, he was a college student in Puerto Rico visiting family in Orlando. He was 33. Juan Chavez Martinez, his co-workers at a hotel say he was a kind, a loving person. He was just 25. Gerald Arthur Wright worked at Disney World. A co-worker says he was wonderful with the guests. He was always smiling. He was 31. Leroy Valentin Fernandez worked leasing apartments. A co-worker says he sang Adele in the office until they couldn't take it anymore. He was 25. Tevin Eugene Crosby, dedicated, hardworking business owner from Michigan. He was just 25. Brenda Lee Marquez McCool, she had 11 kids, beat cancer twice, and often went dancing at Pulse with her gay son. She supported him that much. She was 49. Her son survived the shooting. Angel L. Candelario Padro recently moved to Orlando. He was new here. He had just started a new job as a technician at the Florida Retina Institute. He was 28. Gilberto Ramon Silva Menendez was studying healthcare management. His family says that he was the light and life of all family gatherings. He was 25. Javier Jorge Reyes was a salesman at Gucci. Friends say he was always positive. He was humble, a lovely friend. He was 40. Shane Evan Tomlinson was a gifted singer who performed at weddings and clubs, was 33. Simone Adrian Carrillo Fernandez worked at McDonald's where he brought in birthday cakes for his coworkers and had just gotten back from a trip to Niagara Falls with his partner. He was 31. Oscar Aracena Montero was a Simon's partner. He was 26. They also died together. Rodolfa Ayala worked at a blood donation center, was a Puerto Rican native, loved to dance. He was 33 years old. Frank Hernandez, he worked at a Calvin Klein store, was a great brother and had love, had no gender tattooed on his arm. He was 27. Xavier Emmanuel Serrano Rosado was a dancer, described as hardworking and friendly, proud of his son. He was 33. Akira Monet Murray, she recently graduated from high school, was planning to go to Mercyhurst University and play basketball. She was just 18. And Christopher Joseph Sanfeliz worked at a bank, was said to be the most positive guy around, was just 24 years old. Luis Daniel Conde was a makeup artist, co-owned a salon with his partner. He was 39. Juan P. Rivera Velasquez. He was the partner to Luis. He was 37. Antonio Devon Brown was a captain in the, was a captain in the U.S. Army Reserve and a graduate of Florida A&M. He was 29. Alejandro Barrios Martinez was 21. Joel Rayon Paniagua was 32. Jean Nieves Rodriguez was 27. We don't have pictures of these people. Ilmarie Rodriguez Sullivan was 24. And Paul Terrell Henry was 41 years old. We think it's important that you hear their names.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.